Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local school, business, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 symptom support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org. We're also supported by Hungry Harvest, delivering farm-fresh produce and kitchen staples to your door starting at $15. Every delivery fights food waste and supports local hunger-solving organizations. HungryHarvest.net.
2020 and so far 2021 have really been a time where both the best and the worst of social media have been on really clear display.
I'm Charlie Shelton-Ormond. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina in the South. Today, what goes viral in a pandemic? In a year of quarantining and physical isolation, our social lives have been mediated by screens more than ever. In 2020, American adults spent an average of 82 minutes per day on social media. According to a report by the research company eMarketer, that's up 7 minutes from 2019. That's evidence social media was certainly a staple in our daily lives before the pandemic. But in the last year, it's evolved in a new digital landscape and has grown as a powerful gateway to engage with the rest of the world.
I think social media has really been the lens through which most people have experienced the pandemic. My name is Alice Marwick, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Communication and a principal researcher at the Center for Information, Technology, and Public Life.
As a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, Marwick focuses a large part of her research on the social, cultural, and political significance of social media.
In the very early months of the pandemic, so in March 2020, April 2020, you saw all these kind of very quick trends. You know, people were watching Tiger King, they were baking sourdough, they were making masks. And this was all being experienced on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok. And then as it starts to really settle in, I think social media became a substitute for most people for the interactions that they would have been having face to face. I mean, we could say that Zoom is a type of social media in a lot of ways. Like, it's certainly a type of mediated communication, even if it's not precisely social media. And it's the way that most white collar workers have experienced their professional lives over the last year. So many of these things have shifted to social media, and so many of the experiences that we might have had have just disappeared. Like, there's no live entertainment. We're not going to church. We're not meeting up with our friends. We're not going to parties. We're not spending time in restaurants. And so social media has sort of filled up the space that all of those things took.
But new recipe trends and TikTok dance challenges haven't been the most emblematic use of social media during the pandemic.
I think the protests for racial justice this last summer are some of the most powerful social media moments we've seen in the last year. The combination, I think, of social media being many people's lifeline to the outside world in a year where most people felt very socially isolated, and the fact that activism now happens both online and in the streets, meant that you had these incredibly rich, intense conversations happening online that were also overlapping with very intense experiences that people had while they were protesting or while they were interacting with police or politicians. To me, that sort of embodied some of the best things that social media has to offer. This ability to bring people together, to have conversations without having to be physically in the same space, and to spread information and awareness.
You now see people who have reached all the way up to the entrance of the Capitol on this side, on one set of stairs. On another Capitol Hill, police have also retreated further back another 20 or 30 yards, and the protesters continue
to gain. There is a single Capitol police officer trying to stop this on his own. He is trying to get in between the crowd, trying to enter the U.S. Capitol. Just one police officer.
Let's go!
When we saw the run-up to the Capitol riots, the Capitol takeover on January 6th, that to me was emblematic of some of the worst that social media has to offer, in that it helps to spread these sort of like hateful ideas and conspiracy theories that can have a life of their own, even as they're repeatedly debunked by mainstream media and by experts. So 2020 and so far 2021 have really been a time where both the best and the worst of social media have been on really clear display.
As part of her research, Marwick studies far-right subgroups and their use of social media to spread misinformation. She says members of these groups were clearly present at the Capitol insurrection, but something else caught her attention.
The Capitol insurrection was interesting because it was basically a coalition of groups that might not necessarily agree upon a lot. In that group, you had fairly mainstream Trump supporters, you had flat-out white supremacists, and you had a lot of people in between, from, you know, the QAnon shaman and these very conspiratorial thinkers to people who are Holocaust deniers and believe in like a white ethno-state. So the insurrection was organized virtually completely on social media. And many of the people who participated in it were not people who typically are politically active. They were not people who were economically downtrodden. They weren't people who were very young. They were a broad cross-section of middle class and in upper middle class Republican and conservative people involved in the Capitol riots.
What do you think it is about a pandemic or just about times of crisis in general that increase or spark these channels of this misinformation?
When we go through times of rapid social upheaval, people have a hard time. They want to find simple explanations for some of the complex events that they're experiencing, and they want to find solace in the idea that there is an explanation, that there is a way to view these events that makes sense to them.
Here's one of the problems. As people searched for these explanations, they were met with a rising wave of dubious information. In 2020, unreliable news sources doubled their engagement on social media. That's according to an analysis by NewsGuard, which rates the reliability of news sites and tracks online misinformation.
It's important not to forget that 2020 was an election year, and that there were a lot of really big political events that happened: the pandemic, the protests for racial justice, and the presidential election. I think we would have probably seen an increase in mis and disinformation around those issues regardless. But the fact that many people were getting most of their news or all of their news from social media meant that some of the mediating effects that we might have had of in-person interactions with people with different political beliefs were less than they even would have been otherwise. There'd already been a really big uptake in conspiracy theories and QAnon before the pandemic. But I do have a gut feeling that the pandemic exacerbated it just because people are isolated. And, you know, a lot of people are kind of bored and they're just spending their time sitting online reading stuff on the internet. I think it's easy to fall down these sort of obsessive holes. And sometimes it can be like, you know, I got really into plants this year. I got really into baking this year. Sometimes it can be these like very wholesome things. And sometimes it's things like I got really into QAnon.
At Trump rallies nationwide, the Q pops up in a sea of campaign signs. It stands for QAnon and a long list of false, outlandish, and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories.
QAnon first emerged in the months after President Trump took office, starting on fringe internet message boards before spreading to social media.
The rise of conspiracy theories like QAnon These theories posit really simplistic explanations for complicated social events. QAnon literally divides the world into good versus evil. It's like Star Wars or an action movie. There are winners, there are losers, there are villains, there are heroes, and there's this very lurid, sort of sensational storyline underpinning the whole thing. And I think that really appeals to people because it gives them a very clear sense of what's going on, of who's to blame. And it also allows them to participate in these complicated political events through learning about these conspiracy theories and spreading the conspiracy theories. I think a lot of people feel politically ineffectual. You know, 2020 was a really interesting year because there was a lot of political activism, but many of the traditional ways through which people are politically active, like, for example, going door to door, canvassing for presidential candidates, wasn't really available because of the pandemic. And so people are channeling a lot of this political energy into other things. Sometimes this manifests itself in things like putting up a black square on Instagram to show your support for Black Lives Matter, or sharing resources that are made by Black people, or talking about anti-racism. And sometimes it manifests itself by getting involved in conspiracy theories. The communities that exist around these conspiracy theories are fairly supportive. You can get involved in something like QAnon and find a group of like-minded others with which you can discuss that you have a shared political belief, you have a shared understanding of how the world works, and I think some people find that very comforting. The problem is that this shared understanding doesn't map to reality. It's not true, it's false. And the further people get into that false reality, the harder it is for them to interact with people who don't share it, and the harder it is for them to come out of it and come back to sort of our shared reality.
So it seems like a step, at least in the right direction, is getting rid of misinformation on social media. Have social media platforms done enough to police false and potentially dangerous information on their sites?
Social media has a lot of work to do. You know, I think that Facebook especially has been almost willfully unwilling to accept their role in spreading misinformation and disinformation. One of the biggest changes we've seen was deplatforming Trump. And the cynic in me wants to say, well, you know, many of these social media companies were comfortable deplatforming Trump after Biden won, and they didn't really have to fear Republican regulation anymore. But what that's done is it's cut off this amplification effect, because so many journalists and media outlets believe that they had to cover everything that Trump said, even if the things he were saying were very harmful, like, you know, using racist slurs or talking about injecting bleach or spreading, you know, harmful theories about mail-in ballots or voting machines. You know, this is all disinformation that shouldn't be spread. But because the president is the one who's saying it, it's newsworthy. And I think that having Trump cut off from Twitter and decreasing his ability to speak directly to people, to the electorate, has really helped. And it's made a really big difference in how much these conspiracy theories get amplified.
So if the goal of these groups is to get their message out, how should they be covered then by the media, or just, you know, discussed writ large?
So one of the challenges that I think many of us in this space have grappled with over the last 4 or 5 years is, how do journalists and how do media as a whole and how do researchers and academics talk about these topics and study these topics without amplifying them? And that's a really difficult line to walk. In some ways, I worry that my own research on QAnon amplifies QAnon. I mean, most people who hear this, for example, probably aren't going to go get involved in QAnon, but what if there's someone who had never heard of it before and they do because of something I'm saying about it? So on one hand, I think it's really important for us to understand these dynamics because they are important politically and socially and culturally. On the other hand, I think it's really irresponsible for, say, the New York Times to do a sympathetic profile of a white nationalist, which they did even this year. And you can say, oh, this person is wrong or this person's beliefs aren't true. But if you're, you know, you're doing a glossy photo shoot with them and you're putting their name on a headline, you're making it possible for people to Google them and look into their thoughts and ideas. One of the things we've seen in the last few years is that the names of mass shooters are no longer being publicized by the media. And sometimes when we profile extremists or we talk about fringe belief systems or we talk about people like the Proud Boys, we are amplifying those people who are doing the hurting, and we're not putting the focus on where it belongs, which are the people who actually get hurt by this. For example, recently there's been this enormous uptake in hate crimes against Asian Americans, and many people believe we can trace that uptake specifically to accusations that COVID originated in China or has something to do with the Chinese government or Chinese scientists. And when you amplify and spread those theories, like President Trump did with his use of racist terminology that involved Chinese people and Asian Americans in general, what you're doing is you're making a community more vulnerable to hate. So instead, let's focus on like Asian American activists, or let's focus on people in those communities who are resilient and the strategies that they're using. And I would love to see the media as a whole be spending more time with the communities affected by hate than the people who are spreading the hate themselves.
We've talked about some of the harmful effects of social media, especially in times of crisis like a pandemic, but there's also plenty of benefits that come from these digital connections. And based on what you've observed in the past year, what were the best ways in which social media was, you know, done well? And what can folks take away from that in terms of going forward in the future? You know, once the pandemic is in the rearview mirror, what should we hold on to from those experiences on social media?
There's this sense that when you do something online, like put a black square up on Instagram, that it's just this kind of worthless slacktivism, that it's just performative, that it doesn't have any real world effect. But research actually shows that that's a really effective on-ramp to offline activism for a lot of people. And I think that's what we saw this summer, was there were so many people who were willing to come out in the streets and engage in political action in a really powerful way. Social media has the ability to bring people together and to expose people to ideas that they just never would have been exposed to in a world without it. Imagine what 2020 would have been like if we didn't have social media. Imagine how disconnected and isolated we would have all felt. I mean, we all still feel disconnected and isolated, don't get me wrong, but social media has been such a powerful force for connection and community for so many people. And it's one of the most effective ways for people from marginalized communities or people with viewpoints that don't get covered by the mass media to really reach out and connect and speak their truth and speak about their experiences in ways that people can access and learn from. We're in a moment where people are generally very negative about social media, where there's a lot of critique of social media. And I think virtually all of that critique is warranted. And especially when it comes to the sort of ways these platforms make money or the ways that they use personal information, I think that is all really important to still be criticizing. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's recognize that social media has incredible power for social change and for positive connection. And let's keep that in mind as we move forward into hopefully a brighter future.
Alice Marwick is an assistant professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also a principal researcher at the Center for Information, Technology, and Public Life. More in a moment.
Hey, sorry to interrupt your podcast listening. I'll be quick. I'm Lindsay Foster Thomas. I'm the content director at North Carolina Public Radio WUNC. And I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who supports WUNC. It makes Tested and all the WUNC podcasts and programs possible. If you haven't yet made a contribution, consider doing so now at WUNC.org. More than half of what it takes to operate WUNC comes from listener support, and your support today is so appreciated. become a sustainer or increase your monthly gift at WUNC.org. And thanks.
Now that we've marked a year in the pandemic, it's been inevitable to think back on where everything stood 1 year ago, to remember what we were doing in March of 2020 and how it was all radically upended as a new reality rolled in. As I've reflected on that time a year ago, I've been thinking about some of the people we talked to on this podcast, when Tested was still a pretty new program and we were all searching for ways to cope with what was going on. I've been thinking specifically about a man named Dan Tunstall. Tested co-host Dave DeWitt talked with him last spring. Dan is a resident with his wife at Carolina Meadows, a retirement community in Chapel Hill. At the time, Dan shared with us his experience navigating a virus that's posed a greater threat to older adults.
We're humans and we're social animals. Humans like to congregate families, family structures. Mm-hmm. And my daughter lives 5 miles away, and son-in-law and my granddaughter, and I miss them a lot. And this is kind of our own virus war, and we can handle it. Our parents sure handled it. I think of my mom raising 3 small boys while her husband was in fighting the war in Egypt, and she managed and did well. We can surely do this.
I found Dan's warm spirit comforting back then. His mix of realism and optimism was encouraging at a time when there was still so much up in the air. So now, a year later, I decided to give Dan a call to check back in.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Okay. And you all, you're calling from where?
When I called him, Dan told me the latest news was that he'd received his second dose of the vaccine just a few days prior.
Yes, very recently, just 2 days ago. I thought it would just be easy, and it was, but then both my wife and I couldn't fall asleep that night well, and the next day we ached quite a bit. Of course, my daughter said, that means it's working. So if by the ache monitor, we were doing well, but today we both feel much, much better. And of course, relieved that we are now fully vaccinated. I guess I have to wait another couple of days for sure, maybe a week. Yeah, I think we have to wait a full week. But no, that's a good feeling. And obviously the relief immediately here is that we're going to be able to start to see people a little bit more.
And what are some of the things you're looking forward to doing again pretty soon now that you're vaccinated?
I like to do bicycling. I compete in the senior games here, and so the next senior games will be in June. My big decision is, do I buy a new bike? Last year, I came in second at the state, and the year before that, fourth and third, and so now I'm in the 80-year-old group. So if I'm ever going to win at the senior games, this is the year. So the question is, do I buy a new bike or do I rely on my old one? We'll have to see.
You mentioned not being able to see your family a year ago. I hope you've been able to see your family safely since then. Can you tell me more about what that's going to look like now?
Yeah, that's really important. My daughter and family and son-in-law and granddaughter live 5 miles away. They live in Carrboro. So I do see them, but we always sit outside. We don't eat meals with them. We have our masks on. They have their masks on sitting inside. My daughter's good. She'll just open the door, and even if it's 20 degrees out or 30 degrees, she'll open the door and we'll sit outside and we'll talk with our masks and they'll have their masks on. So we've all been really safe. But she makes good coffee. We like to sit inside. So that's getting close. I think we're a week away. And also, she likes me to do weeding and painting, and I like doing that too. So this will be a real good cup of coffee, and then I get to weed in their driveway in their yard for an hour. So,
and spend more time with your granddaughter. Yeah.
Yes, she's 7, really smart. She can read like mad now. Used to be I would take her to the public library and we would do stuff together. And of course, then all that stopped for this year. So, you know, I haven't given her a hug in a year, and that's amazing. So
that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what's exciting in life, isn't it?
I encouraged Dan to spring for the new bike. I think he's deserved it. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Charlie Shelton-Ormond. Dave DeWitt will be back again next week. Amanda Magnus is our editor. And if you want to hear more on how social media has influenced the political news landscape, I recommend checking out the most recent episode of the Politics Podcast from WUNC. Thanks for listening.